those in exile, please let us come home. And here's the decision of the city of New Orleans to destroy 5,000 perfectly usable units of affordable housing. Supposedly with this plan that we're going to update it and we're going to make it better. And the people were just crying at this meeting. 72-year-old woman who was in Texas, please, I just want to come home. My apartment is on the second floor. It didn't even flood. And it's neat and tidy and waiting for me. Let us come home. And I could see the passive, non-reflective faces of the authorities. It reminded me of pardon boards in Louisiana when people are making an appeal to them to give them clemency so they're not executed, and there they are appointed by the governor. You know what they're going to do. So when the people of the St. Bernard, one of the housing developments, decided to take back their houses, and I went with them, and I helped them clean up, and then that led me to speak out, you know. Affordable housing started getting cut in this country in the 70s under President Nixon. Poor people are, it's risen, poor poverty's risen 17% under George W. Bush. And it's, you know, Rollo May, a profound psychologist and really a wise man, said, you know, the opposite of love is not hate, it's to ignore. And so we have tremendous struggles here. They're gentrifying the city. Rents have gone up at least 50%. In many cases, the rents have gone up 70%. And there are 280,000 people out of New Orleans, and 220,000 of them are black. Poor black people. So I could see the connections with all these issues.
Yeah.
Well, you touched on the death penalty, which of course is where we're going to go next. I don't know if you're aware of the situation here in Hawaii. But
yeah, I heard about that deputy kill.
Yeah, Hawaii has abolished a death penalty.
We face this in Minnesota and states that don't have the death penalty, and in comes the federal government and says, we're going to do it anyway. I mean, there it is. And you know what amazes me about this case? The Supreme Court has given as a guideline, when it put the death penalty back in the Gregg decision in 76, that the death penalty is to be administered for the, in quotes, worst of the worst murders. Now, supposedly there's supposed to be a discernment process here. Of course, people, you know, really don't know what worst of the worst means. How do you distinguish an, in quotes, ordinary murder from worst of the worst? Because whenever a human being is killed by violence, the universe is lost. There's no way we lose our footing in trying to even deal with these criteria. But in this case, because interstate commerce was involved, made it a federal offense. And so worst of the worst means, is there interstate commerce? Imagine having that as a criteria that the federal government uses to determine whether or not you're going to kill a human being for their crimes. And this case clearly shows it. And it comes out of that mentality that we're going to control social problems through violence. Mm. And the paradigm that the death penalty represents is Iraq in larger print. It's the same paradigm, though. Just like we're going to go for these criminals and punish them with the ultimate penalty, death, so we go after terrorists, and so we're in Iraq and Afghanistan, and now with our eyes in the United States set on Iran as well. That violence is the way you solve social problems. And it really highlights it. It illumines it. It exposes it for what it is.
Well, there's been a move afoot to increase the request for death penalty among states that have it already.
The states that have it, to increase it. What do you mean?
To increase the requests for it.
Where's that?
There's...
It's happening.
Oh, Tell me more about that.
Yeah, because last year was the lowest number of executions since the death penalty was put back, 53. Death sentences are on decline. This started in 2001, triggered by DNA evidence that was showing that we thought we had the best court system in the world, yeah, and innocent people were being sent onto death row along with the guilty. Governor Ryan in Illinois, who had always supported the death penalty, was one of the first to stand before the nation and say 13 innocent people have been shown to have been sent onto death row in Illinois, and he declared a moratorium. And then a book came out about how DNA was being the truth-telling machine, and what it did, it exposed the courts. DNA is not a the silver bullet to deal with guilt to innocence, because usually DNA evidence is only present in one in every four homicides. But what it did was expose that we had a faulty court system. We thought we had all these appeals, surely they'd catch any mistake.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it really, that's my second book, The Death of Innocence, exposing how the courts, when it goes into the appeals courts, they don't go back and look at the merits of the case. They don't go back and look at the evidence. They don't go back and see which jailhouse informant lied or which evidence was suppressed. They just look at very narrow constitutional issues and the procedural faults kick into place. Like, sorry you didn't file this in time. Well, I didn't have an attorney. Well, it's up to you to get an attorney for your appeals, or my attorney was inadequate.
Mm-hmm.
So what's happened is, as the American public has grown in recognition of these faults that are part of this, the desire for the death penalty has dwindled. What it has also shown us is that the regional disparity of practice, the southern states that practice slavery account for over 80% of all executions, whereas now the count is that in 27 states, there's 12 states that don't have the death penalty on as a statute, but now added to that have been 15 states which, because of legal questions and questions about lethal injection and how it's administered by just technicians and whether or not it involves torture, is putting the death penalty on hold in more and more states. So the movement is in the opposite direction now in the United States.
I had read a story, I think it was in USA Today, that talked about how the states that do have it, the certain states where it is, you know,
like Texas practices it vociferously.
Yes, and even and are planning to be even more vociferous.
Yeah, well, they are approaching their 400th execution. So then we have to look at, law is supposed to be a rudder. Law is supposed to help people do justice.
Yeah.
How do we account for such regional disparity in the climate and in the practice with the death penalty? And once you start linking it to race, what would it be about southern states that used violence to keep slaves in place, and then when slaves were freed, put in some of the harshest penal codes in their legislatures to punish black people for crime?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's the pattern you really see at play in Texas, my own state, Louisiana, Georgia, Florida, Alabama, you know, Mississippi, North Carolina, South Carolina. And you got to ask a question. When you see a pattern happening, whereas only 1% of all the executions have happened in the Northeast, even for the states that had it on the books. And now we see that New Jersey, New York, Maryland, a whole number of these states are saying, we're spending too much money to keep this machinery of death in place. Let's just do away with it.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them take the first step of moratorium. They take a hard look at it, and then they go, it's not worth it. New York had the death penalty in place for 9 years, and they spent $180 million. And the finally, the people put it down. They had hearings, and they just went, think what we could have done with those resources. And I don't frame the death penalty issue and divide it into there the moral questions, which is religious or philosophical, and then there are the practical questions of money. I believe the way you spend your money and the resources is a very moral question. Martin Luther King used to say, the most moral document you'll ever look at is a budget. And then you take the millions of dollars in place to carry out, to keep this machinery of death, where it's so seldom used in most, and you, to keep that in place, like New York, ended up with four people on death row, and most people were saying they're never going to be executed.
Hello?
You know?
Yeah.
all this money. So people are looking at everything and they're reconsidering. I think the war in Iraq and seeing how violence doesn't always achieve these so-called democratic ideals is also reverberating into people's reflection on the death penalty.
Well, we better get on to the other two questions. I don't want to... Because
okay,
I could ask you. The other two are actually a little shorter. The movie based on your encounter with Matthew, and I can't pronounce
Matthew
it.
Matthew Plunkett is a composite character.
Right.
Made up of two people that I was with, which I tell about in Dead Man Walking, Patrick Saunier and Robert Lee Willie.
Okay.
So my encounter with Patrick Saunier first.
Okay. I'll look up the spelling of those names.
Okay, I'll give it to you. Saunier is S-O-N-N-I-E-R.
Okay.
And I'm sure you can handle the Patrick.
Yes. And the other one was?
Robert Lee, L-E-E, Willie, W-I-L-L-I-E.
Okay. Who became the Matthew Plunkett. Okay. In Dead Men Walking.
So I don't have a relationship with Matthew Plunkett.
Right.
Just be
right.
Clear about
exactly.
That. Okay.
But that movie gave you a pretty wide pulpit.
Yeah, big time.
How did it change what you do?
Well, what it did was, there were 1.3 billion people watching the night of the Academy Awards, March 25th, 1996.
Yeah.
Dead Man had 4 nominations, Susan got it, and it just gave the movie over to the world. What it gave over to the world was discourse and reflection on the death penalty, including in our own country. This precipitated me then onto the public front. And so what it did for me is, I say, when you're a nun and you're famous, what it means is you get more work. Because all these invitations, will you come speak here? Will you come to our church? Will you come to our university? And that's my mission. I know I'm also a Southerner and I'm a storyteller. And I've found a way. I'm going to do this when I come to Hawaii, too, to take people through the journey, because everybody struggles with the outrage we feel when an innocent person has been killed, like this deputy, this young deputy. I mean, and the plunging his family into grief, his wife, his children. I presume he has a wife and children. I'm not sure about
that. Yes, he does.
But the family who loved him and who depended on him. So how do we navigate our way to own this outrage that we feel, deal with it, but then to take a look into our deeper values as a society, and then to look at the moral costliness of what it means to set ourselves up as the arbiters of truth and falsehood, that we will decide who lives and who dies. And I take people through both sides of that question. I take them through the victims' families that I have known, the choices victims' families make, and increasingly people who are standing up and saying the death penalty re-victimizes us. Bud Welch, W-E-L-C-H, his daughter Julie, was killed in the Oklahoma City bombing by Timothy McVeigh. And Bud Welch finally had to work it through. At first, like most victims' families, all he could think was, I want to kill McVeigh with my bare hands. That's the starting point for most people. You're in rage. You're in confusion. You focus your anger. You got to focus for your anger. And then he came to, look, if I go witness this guy's execution, when I come home, the chair is still going to be empty, where Julie is never going to sit again. And so I'm going to watch the state kill somebody. He said over half of the victims' families, 168 families of the Oklahoma City bombing, had worked to that point by the time he came to the execution. They chose not to go. because mm-hmm. they knew it wasn't going to do anything for them. And many of them are saying the death penalty re-victimizes us. It forces us to wait 10, 15, sometimes 20 years. Then we're told, come sit on the front. Reading for this illusory healing that's supposed to come from witnessing the death of another human being. And many of them are seeing through it and they're speaking out. And that's part of the reason that the death penalty is now on the decline in the United States mm-hmm. because of their voice.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and then we've gotten the four big questions out of the way. So I always like to follow up with the silly question.
Okay, give me a silly.
You ready?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm guessing we're the year of the Dead Man Walking.
You're guessing what?
That year,
96,
that you were probably the only nun on the red carpet. Did anyone
yes,
ask?
Let me tell you about that red carpet.
Well, did anybody ask you, who are you wearing?
Oh, God, I had to deal with that clothing question. All the media interviews before, they go, what is a nun wearing the Academy Awards? It was so silly and funny. So finally, I just told them, I'm going to wear a little black top and a skirt. And then that went out over the Associated Press, and that dealt with that question. And you know where you walk on the red carpet if you're not Susan Sarandon and Tim Robbins?
Yeah.
They have this bar down the middle of the carpet. There's a red carpet to the right, and there's a red carpet to the left.
Oh.
And the red carpet to the left had the bleachers, the grandstands where all the media was, and that's the gauntlet Susan had to go through. And I just walked in. It was fun, though. Whoopi Goldberg was the MC that night, and it was amazing. Of course, Susan had been nominated four other times,
yeah.
And so she was so nervous because she was a front runner, you know. And
right.
So it was pretty amazing. And how it got the word out. I was in Japan 6 weeks or so after the Academy Awards,
yeah.
And the taxi cab driver was going, "Get men walking." And then it got into the vernacular. It,
yeah.
They started using it about a politician that wasn't doing too well, and they go, "He's a dead man walking." So anyway, it's good to be of service, and a book is a service to people. You help bring them into this. And so what the movie did then was just bring the book to the world. It's been translated into 12 languages, and it gets people reflecting on something that they are never going to see, because finally when the state does kill, it's a secret ritual with just a few people
right.
brought in, and most people don't see it, and so they can't really look at the moral costliness of what it means to take an alive person and strap them down and kill them. Well,